felt like a bored soldier settling in for a long voyage.
And do you?
I think you know better than that. Or at least, I hope you do.
The hold is lit only with bare light bulbs screwed into fixtures in the ceiling and set at 15-foot intervals. There are no portholes or other means of letting in natural light. The space is dim and murky, but Thomas sees my smile anyway. The one he returns is enough to make my stomach flip. His presence makes the journey to Tumen bearable, and when I emerge into the fresh early evening air 3 days later, he isn't far behind. The train is waiting, but Semyon refuses to let us board until our belongings are loaded into one of the freight cars. It is dark, and we are hungry by the time we follow him down the platform to a dirty third-class carriage near the rear of the train. Gilliard, Botkin, and Cook move to follow us up the stairs, but Semyon stops them.
No, he says, barring the way. You're at the back, in the goods wagon.
Gilliard steps forward. His voice is drenched with offense.
You cannot mean to separate us from the children. It's not appropriate.
As usual, Semyon's indecent stare falls on Olga. I think he looks her up and down purposefully just to make Gilliard furious.
Oh, they're hardly children. But you have no say in the matter regardless. You can take your place at the back of the train or you can stay behind. It matters little to me what you decide.
Gilliard steps away from the train, hands raised slightly in defeat. Semyon turns to Thomas and says,
Go to the office and have the station master wire Katerinburg. Tell him to say the baggage is loaded and will be delivered tomorrow.
On the way to Tobolsk, we were given an entire car, but now we are confined to a single compartment. The other compartments in this car are occupied by Semyon and a handful of guards. The rest of the Red Guard files onto the remaining cars. There are four bunks in our compartment, and I notice immediately that the mechanism allowing us to lock the door has been broken off. All vestige of daylight is gone, and there is no mention of dinner. So Alexei scrambles into one of the upper bunks without comment and reaches for Joy. I hand the little spaniel to him, and they curl up beneath the threadbare blanket and are asleep in moments. It takes much longer for my sisters and I to settle in. It is nearly midnight by the time the train whistle blows and those rusty old wheels begin to clatter down the tracks. The movement is jarring at first, so different from the steamship, and I rock back and forth in my berth, trying to adjust. I know my sisters are awake, but we don't speak. They are stacked in the bunks across from me, Tatiana on the bottom with Ortimo beside her and Olga on top. I can barely see my sisters in the darkness over Jimmy's huge, snoring body. After an hour, we start to drift off, but are startled awake by raucous bursts of laughter from the other compartments.
Do you think they're drinking?
Tatiana asks finally.
Yes, I say. Do you think they're dangerous?
Yes, I say again. We force ourselves back to sleep. But I wake when Jimmy's snoring becomes a dangerous rumble. It is matched within seconds by growling from Ortimo and Joy. My eyes are wide, but my body is still as a brick when the door to our compartment slides open. The light from the hallway reveals three men standing in silhouette.
We thought you girls might like to play,
comes Semyon's deep, oily voice. The three of us remain completely silent as the growling of our dogs grows more urgent. I shrink back against the wall, claiming every inch of distance I can. In the bunk above me, I can hear Alexei moan in that high-pitched, terrified way of his. Be quiet, I will him silently. Ortimo, bless his brave little heart, is off Tatiana's bunk and on the floor barking madly the moment Semyon sets foot within the compartment. When Semyon takes another step, Ortimo shrinks back, afraid of him once more. But Semyon is drunk and bold, and he reaches down and grabs Tatiana's little bulldog by the collar before teeth can meet flesh. He lifts Ortimo in one hand and shakes him.
I should have shot you months ago,
Semyon hisses, rattling him again, harder, and Ortimo yelps, legs flailing as he tries to fight his way free. Semyon laughs.
Not such a fierce guard dog after all, are you?
Put him down, please, Tatiana begs, crawling to the edge of her bunk, a note of desperation in her voice. It makes me sick to my stomach. I hate to hear her beg that man for anything. Semyon's grin is malicious. Tatiana pulls back.
I'd be happy to, he says,
and then crosses to the window. He opens it with his free hand, and without another word, pitches Ortimo into the darkness. The wind howls at the open window, but it isn't enough to drown out the little dog's terrified yelp. I did not know my sister could make such a noise, but she throws herself at Semyon, scratching and clawing and shrieking. She may as well have been beating a brick wall for all the good it does. He bats her hands away and then grips them tightly, grinding her wrists together. Tatiana cries out in pain and her knees buckle.
Take her,
Semyon says to one of the guards behind him. And just like that, as if she was some discarded piece of luggage, he hands her off. And I watch as my sister is dragged down the hall to some compartment out of sight. She thrashes and screams, but it does no good. Seconds later, a door opens, and a group of unseen men cheer her arrival. Semyon turns to the other guard, face still shrouded in darkness, and points at me.
You can have that one. I want her sister.
He has always wanted Olga. That much has been clear since he painted the graffiti on the garden wall at Alexander Palace. He has wanted her and has waited for his opportunity. Tormented her. Mocked her. Semyon has molested her with his gaze 100 times, and those eyes burn bright now as he steps toward her bunk. He's been patient. He's been shrewd. This is why he ingratiated himself with Yakov, and why he dismissed Leshy. He has finally manufactured the chance to put his fantasy into action. I hate myself for staying frozen and terrified as he reaches up and pulls Olga from her bunk. I hate how thin and feeble her arms look as they hit him, how perfectly useless they are. I hate myself for not grabbing my paper knife and slashing at his arrogant, cruel, hideous face. And I hate her screams, because I cannot make them stop. They echo those of Tatiana down the hall, growing louder and more frantic by the second. But mostly, I hate Semyon. Hate him like I have hated no one before. When Semyon cannot get a decent hold on Olga's arms, he hooks an arm around her chest, one hand gripping her breast, and drags her from the compartment while she twists and writhes and screams. In the chaos, I've forgotten Jimmy, forgotten that bulwark of canine fury between the door and me. He isn't barking. He doesn't need to. Jimmy's entire body quivers with rage as that last guard takes one tentative step and then another. Toward me.
Part 3. This too shall pass. The great enemy of the truth is very often not the lie, deliberate, contrived, and dishonest, but the myth, persistent, persuasive, and unrealistic. John F. Kennedy. Chapter 23. Anna. Friends at last. 1925-1922. Romanisches Café, Berlin. January 1925. Thank you so much for getting me out of that house, Anna says. I couldn't take it any longer. I don't know how you've managed this long. 3 years with Maria von Kleist would drive anyone to distraction. That woman is... Tanya waves her hand around in a circle, searching for the right word. Devious.
Oh, look at you being polite this morning. I was going to call her a harpy.
Maria is the wife of Baron von Kleist, and together they are her benefactors. Russian émigrés deeply loyal to the old regime. Generous, but meddlesome. Anna is grateful for the home, but sometimes it's all a bit much.
You know, the harpy is a mythical creature I've never really understood.
Tanya takes off her fur-lined cap and shakes the snowflakes from her hair. Half woman, half bird. Screechy, smelly, bosoms hanging out. Clearly invented by some impotent man hell-bent on subjugating his wife. And this is why Anna has grown fond of Tanya Botkin. She has opinions, and she speaks them aloud, frequently. And not only this, but she is funny and sure of herself, and has an utter disregard for her own reputation. She is refreshing. Tanya can also be counted on in a pinch to rescue Anna from the confines of the Baron's drawing room and his prim, scheming wife. It's snowing in Berlin, but everyone knows this is a preamble to a ferocious blizzard. Before long, the entire city will be locked indoors. But for now, the flakes are coming down like cotton balls, thick and puffy. They stick to the street, and the lampposts, and the cars parked outside the cafe. The snow is the only reason they could get a table. The Romanisches Café is known for its eccentric clientele. Artists and musicians and political dissenters who gather for coffee in the morning, beer in the afternoon, and schnapps at night. It's exactly the sort of place Tanya would like, and it is, with few exceptions, filled to overflowing. Apparently the artsy types don't care for inclement weather. Tanya has secured them a coveted seat by the window without any trouble.
"I wouldn't worry too much about Maria von Kleist if I were you," Tanya says.
She takes a sip of her lager and then licks froth from her bottom lip.
"She's all bark and no bite."
"That's just it. She doesn't bark, ever. She watches and listens and then slips off to whisper in her husband's ear. I feel like I'm being kept out of some big secret. It makes me nervous."
Tanya waves this observation away and then peels off her heavy wool coat.
"Maria imagines herself the puppet master in that relationship. If she were a smarter woman, she would realize that the Baron does what he wants. Besides, you won't be with him much longer, regardless. Gleb has found someone sympathetic to your cause. You'll be moving to Bavaria soon."
"Bavaria?"
"Castle Zeon, to be exact. It's gorgeous. You'll love it."
Tanya looks flushed now, suddenly nervous. She takes a deep breath and pulls two small packages from a deep pocket inside her coat and sets them on the table.
"I have something for you."
"What is this?" The packages are wrapped in brown paper and tied with string. Tanya pushes them across the table.
"Go on, don't be shy."
"What's the occasion?"
"Do I need an occasion to give my friend a gift?"
"I don't have anything for you."
"Oh, good grief, it's not Christmas. Besides, these belong to you anyway. I thought it was time you had them back."
Now Anna is truly curious.
"Which should I open first?"
"Doesn't matter."
The larger package is thin and about 8 inches square. She pulls one end of the string and it unravels easily. Inside is a photo album with a cracked leather cover. She doesn't look at Tanya as she lifts the lid. There are 30 stiff cardboard pages inside, each page covered front and back with black and white photographs. Anna sets her finger lightly on the first picture. 5 little faces stare back at her. 4 dark-haired, light-eyed girls, and 1 chubby-cheeked baby boy. Slowly, carefully, Anna turns the pages, realization dawning. Each is filled with small moments of a private life. Amateur photographs taken by the Romanov family and their friends. These pages give quiet glimpses of a loving, tight-knit family and their closest friends. Gleb and Tanya are sprinkled across the pages as well, usually in the arms of their father. Beneath each picture is written names, dates, and sparse details in a tiny, precise script. Anna tries to speak but chokes on her own voice.
I have kept it ever since you gave it to my father in Tobolsk. Gleb and I would look at it sometimes when we thought you... She clears her voice. When everything happened. I wanted you to have it back. I know it hurts to see their faces, but I think it would probably hurt worse to forget them.
I don't know what to say.
Don't say anything. Just take it, please. You gave it to me once, and it brought great comfort. I hope it does the same for you.
Tanya nudges the long, slender package closer to Anna.
Open this one, too.
She obeys because she does not know what else to do. The simple act of pulling string and ripping paper grounds her to this moment, and she is able to keep the other overwhelming emotions at bay. Tanya does not know, cannot know, the importance of what she has just given her. The paper knife is heavy and ornate. It has a silver blade and a mother-of-pearl handle. Anna runs her hand over the embossed emblem of Empress Alexandra. She looks at Tanya again, speechless.
Gilliard gave it to me afterward, she says. He told me how he always regretted taking it from you at the train station. He said he used to lie awake at night and wonder if he'd robbed you of your only means of protection. Not that a paper knife is much of a defense.
Tanya looks up, apologetic. This is not a thing they openly discuss, and her eyes are wet. She shrugs.
He said he was sorry, for everything. For being so hard on you in the classroom, and for not insisting they let him follow you into Ekaterinburg. He has never forgiven himself.
3 years earlier. Borough of Nettelbeckerstrasse, Berlin. June 6th, 1922. There is a gentle knock at the door, and Anna shoves the hand mirror beneath her coverlet. She's sitting up in the massive bed, alternately nibbling at a French roll and inspecting her new hairstyle. The Kleists insist on having their maid serve her breakfast in bed every morning. At first, she found this strange and unnecessary, but she's grown quite fond of the ritual in the week that she has lived with them. It gives her a few moments alone before being forced to spend the day with her benefactors. They love nothing more than talking and shopping and sightseeing. Anna finds it exhausting, but suspects they've stayed so busy because they don't really know what to do with her. Regardless, she has become familiar with Nettelbeckstrasse and the surrounding areas. She now knows where to go if she needs to leave. If. Funny how she's gone from must to if in a mere 7 days. Anna isn't stupid. She knows this newfound comfort has weakened her resolve. And why not? She argues with herself. It's been a very long time since she had any comfort to speak of. Why shouldn't she enjoy a warm bed and then breakfast the next morning? This new haircut, however, is a strange development. Anna has never worn her hair short, can't remember a time that it didn't drape well past her shoulders. Yet the Baron's wife swept into her room the day before and announced that she'd procured an appointment with Monsieur Antoine and that Anna should put on her best dress and come quickly. And so began a surreal visit with a Polish hairdresser who went by a French name and was in Germany for only 3 more days before returning to America. Anna wasn't sure how Maria von Kleist appropriated one of his 3 available appointments, but she did know that the haircut cost 500 marks, a detail she attributed to her newfound penchant for eavesdropping. Maria hadn't been so much complaining when she told her husband the cost as adding it to Anna's ever-growing tab. After an hour in Monsieur Antoine's chair, her typically lank, dark hair rested in thick waves against her chin. He explained that the style could be worn straight or curly, but he suggested she wear it curly, given the natural wave of her hair. It feels strange and in the way, but Anna can't deny that it makes her look older and sophisticated. She hasn't been able to stop looking at the change, examining her face and the angle of her jaw in every mirror or window she passes. Again the knock at the door, this time louder and more urgent. Anna realizes that it has been nearly a minute and she hasn't yet answered.
Komm herein!
The maid pushes the door open and ducks her head in respect.
You have visitors, Tsarevna.
She looks at the clock.
I didn't think the Mahjong party was until much later.
The Baron's wife is oddly obsessed with the Chinese game, played by removing tiles from a board. She has insisted that Anna join her and her friends in playing it twice this week already. There is another round scheduled for this afternoon. Anna cannot for the life of her think of a polite way to excuse herself.
These guests are not for Frau Kleist. They are for you.
She lowers her voice and whispers,
Russian emigres.
The maid walks to the wardrobe and opens it. She pulls out a beaded cream dress and lays it at the foot of the bed along with a petal-pink cloche and satin heels. She is so specific with these choices that Anna suspects that Maria von Kleist told her exactly what to choose. Just as well. Anna likes the way she looks in white. May I help you dress? The maid asks this every day, and Anna refuses just as often.
No, thank you, I can manage.
It's bad enough when the girl stares at the scars along her temple and clavicles. She can't tolerate the thought of her seeing the rest.
I'll be out shortly.
As soon as the maid steps out of the room, Anna rushes to finish the remainder of her breakfast and dress. If nothing else, the Baron's wife has good taste. The ensemble makes her look elegant. This new style of dress favors the tall, tubular woman, but Anna wears it well enough even though she is short and busty. There are some things not even a wealthy patron can change. She follows the maid to the drawing room, where a man and woman wait. It is clear that they are brother and sister, very close in age, if not actually twins, and not that much younger than Anna. They gasp in unison when she enters the room. And then they are on their feet, bending at the waist and curtsying. Anna looks to the Kleists in alarm. The Baron is flushed with joy, while his wife is utterly stunned. Stupefied, actually, sitting there on the settee, her jaw completely slack at the response Anna has drawn from their guests. The way the young man bows reverently and whispers his greeting makes the hairs on Anna's arm stand up. Tsarevna. And then his sister speaks.
Anastasia, we finally found you, he says in Russian.
And then there is a rush of words and chatter and joy. Anna holds up a hand and the room falls quiet.
In German, please,
she says, her voice strangled.
Russian is dead to me now.
Clearing of throats, flushed cheeks, apologies.
Of course, the young man says. We understand. Forgive us.
Anna is frozen to the spot as they step closer. She extends a hand, partly to stop the approach, partly to appear friendly, and the young man takes it lightly and turns it in his hand so he can kiss the back of her knuckles. He releases it quickly and steps back in deference. They are all looking to her, but she doesn't know what to do, so Maria motions toward the furniture.
Please, everyone take a seat.
The guests settle back in their places, and Anna chooses the chair closest to the open window. Maria von Kleist is smoking again, a Helmar Turkish cigarette tucked into the end of an ivory holder. Anna detests the smell of cigarette smoke. It reminds her of gunpowder and fire and death. Anna refuses to smoke, despite much cajoling. It has become one of those things society women do together, in an effort to look elegant and prolong inane conversation. She wonders if all the drawing rooms in Berlin are filled with choking clouds of smoke. The Baron cannot contain himself. He leaps triumphantly from the couch.
You see it too, then? This is Anastasia. We found her. She's alive. Only a fool would mistake her for anyone else, the man says.
It could be no one else, the girl says.
Her hair is the same brown as her brother's, eyes the same green, but her face isn't as nicely formed as his. She is pretty in a pleasant but forgettable way, until she smiles at Anna, and then she is transformed.
Of course you don't recognize us. It's been so long. I am Tanya Botkin, and this is my brother, Gleb.
Gleb Botkin is the sort of handsome that can make a woman stare. And this is exactly what Anna does. taking in his perfectly angled square jaw, straight nose, and long black lashes. There are observations she would like to make about his mouth as well, but she realizes that she hasn't yet answered Tanya.
"Of course," Anna clears her throat. "Of course I remember you."
1 week earlier. Bara of Nettelbeckstrasse, Berlin. May 30th, 1922. Anna is not asleep, but the Kleist family doesn't know this. The Baron and his wife sit quietly in the front seat as their vehicle rumbles through the streets of Berlin, but it is their children, two young girls with almond-shaped eyes and a gift for incessant chatter, who make Anna uncomfortable. The girls aren't twins, but they could be, given how close they are in age and appearance. Dark hair, brown eyes, pale skin, bright freckles, tiny clefts in their tiny chins. They are pretty and strange, and they want to talk to Anna, to pat her hands and offer their eager smiles. They want to please. Anna wants to pull away from their small, cold fingers and their desire to impress. But she can't. They're all crammed together in the back seat of the Baron's car, so Anna has taken to feigning sleep instead.
"Why is she asleep, Mama?" one of the girls asks.
"She's tired, darling."
"But it's daytime."
"She's tired on the inside. She's been through a lot."
"But I want her to wake up," the other girl chimes in. "Can I poke her?"
"No." Then softer. "No. She'll wake up soon enough. Let her rest for now."
The situation isn't ideal, of course. Anna would like to know where she is, where they are taking her, but she needs to gather her wits and determine how long she must endure their company before she can slip away. A week? Maybe a few days? Any sooner would be suspicious. She does not want people looking for her again. But Anna is without resources. She has only the clothes on her back and a small satchel with a nightgown and basic toiletries. No money. No papers. She doesn't even have a map, much less a sense of direction. If she's going to leave the Kleists, she'll need to go about it the right way. Anna's cheek is pressed to the window, and her hair hangs across her face like a drape. But still she persists in this facade. Anna watches bits of the city pass through slit eyes. A long manicured hedgerow, sidewalks, manor houses, and then the street gets narrower and turns to cobblestone. The passing cars become more frequent and expensive on this artery that leads into the heart of the city. They pass a fish market. The buildings stretch taller. More brick, less stone. Lamp posts and street signs and crowded corners filled with bistro tables and pretty women in spring dresses. Paper boys standing on milk crates and peddling the morning headlines. The clatter of a crowded omnibus. The Kleist girls slide into her when the car turns hard to the right into the Nettelbeckstrasse, a wealthy district of Berlin filled with Russian emigres, lesser noblemen, and the independently wealthy. It's quieter here, still vibrant but moneyed and restrained.
"Can we be sure that woman is really Anastasia Romanov?" Maria von Kleist's voice is little more than a whisper in the front seat, and Anna has to strain to hear her husband's reply.
"No, we can't," the Baron says.
"So there's no way to really know who we've invited into our home?"
"I'm afraid not."
"We're fools," she hisses. "We'll be the laughingstock of this entire city."
The Baron sighs.
"Listen, this is a risk worth taking. If that woman is the Grand Duchess, we will be at a great advantage when the old order is restored." "If it's restored." "It will be. There's no other option. I doubt Lenin will remain in power. The other Romanovs will be found as well."
The Baron has one of those calm, reassuring voices, so level and sincere that he makes others feel as though all is right in the world.
"I don't even know if the Tsar or his family is still alive. No one has seen any of them in 4 years. The rumors about what happened in Ekaterinburg are ghastly."
"They're rumors."
The gentle tapping of a long fingernail on the window fills the silence. Maria von Kleist is thinking. Anna holds her breath and stays very still, afraid of being caught eavesdropping. Finally, she asks, "And if that isn't Anastasia, if we've been duped?" Anna imagines him shrugging, unconcerned, behind the wheel. "Then we find a way to get rid of her. It won't matter in the end. We'll be considered heroes and patriots, either way. Or fools. Maybe you're right. Maybe the others are dead. It's tragic, certainly. But even that works in our favor. If that young woman is the last surviving Romanov, it means we've rescued an empress." A sly change of tone. "And she will be indebted to us." "Exactly." At least Anna understands what they're getting at now. She isn't so much worried about their machinations as she is intrigued by them. She's not unfamiliar with politics, moves and counter-moves. If the Kleists plan on using her, Anna is more than happy to return the favor. A few minutes later, they pull to the curb beside a tall, ornate building with wrought iron flower boxes beneath each window. The car door opens so abruptly that Anna almost spills into the street. She barely catches herself before landing on the feet of a doorman, and then makes a show of stretching and yawning to convince the Kleists that she's just woken up. "Fräulein," he says, extending a hand and offering to help her out. Anna hesitates only a moment before taking his hand. The girls slide across the seat, giggling as the doorman lifts them up by their little waists and plants them gently on the sidewalk, then moves on to help Maria von Kleist out as well. Baron von Kleist unfolds his long body from the car and stretches, while the doorman retrieves Anna's bag from the trunk. "Welcome to our home," the Baron says, sweeping his arm toward the enormous grand facade. The building is 8 stories tall and swallows nearly half the block. Anna gapes. "This is your home?"
"Yes."
"All of it?" He laughs then, genuine and good-humored.
"Of course not."
"Only the top floor," his wife adds. There is barely enough room inside the elevator for Anna, the Kleists, and the doorman. She shrinks into the corner, trying not to panic as the grate slams shut and the cage rises with a clang and a squeal toward the 8th floor. When it stops 30 seconds later, she finally exhales. They pile into an elegant foyer with parquet floors and wall sconces that frame a gilded mirror, hung above a console table set with a vase of fresh spring flowers. The Kleist's apartment has vaulted ceilings, polished floors, and arched windows with leaded panes. There are 3 bedrooms and 3 bathrooms, all of them flooded with light and draped with expensive fabrics. There is a dining room, a drawing room, a family room, an office for the Baron, and a kitchen somewhere at the back that Anna never sees. But it is the guest room that nearly brings Anna to tears. "This is where you will stay," Maria von Kleist tells her, swinging the door open to a bright, lovely room with a 4-poster bed, a dressing table, and an armoire. It has its own furnished balcony and a bathroom with a claw-foot tub. "Why don't you freshen up? Make yourself at home. Rest for a while. I know this is all very overwhelming." "Thank you." Anna touches her dry cheeks and cracked lips, runs her fingers through her knotted hair, looks around for her satchel. "I'll have your things washed, but you won't need them right away." Maria opens the armoire and reveals an entire wardrobe of new clothing, complete with tags, hanging inside. There are slippers and undergarments neatly stacked at the bottom. She looks a little embarrassed.
"I guessed your size. We can exchange anything that doesn't fit."
"I don't..."
"It's the least we can do. You were in that horrid place for so long. If we'd only known, we would have come sooner."
"But I can't..."
"Let us help you, please. You don't owe us anything."
Her words are kind, but her body is stiff and ill at ease. "Take your time." And then the great mahogany door to her room closes, and Anna is alone, really, truly alone for the first time since that night on the Bendler Bridge. She can hear the Kleist family chatting in German with some faceless member of the household, a woman with a deep voice. But the sounds are muffled and distant. Anna takes her boots off and sets them against the wall. Her stockings have holes in the toes, so she peels them off as well and tucks them into the toe of one boot. They are not nice enough to go in the armoire with her new things. Perhaps not even worth keeping now that she has new things. Anna hasn't owned anything store-bought since she was 17. Everything since then has been handmade. She runs her fingers along the fine stitching and gauzy material of the new clothing. She inhales the deep, earthy coriander fragrance of silk and cotton. Anna strokes the pillows on her bed and the curtains at her window. She walks barefoot across the oriental carpet. Anna sheds her clothing on the way to the bathroom, the way a snake sheds its skin in spring, one long, continuous peel falling to the ground. She doesn't notice the dirt beneath her toenails or the grime at her ankles until she stands naked on the polished white marble. The air is cool and smells of towels dried in the sun. Anna doesn't care that the curtains are open or that anyone in the apartments across the street could see her if they only looked out their own immaculate windows. All she sees or cares about or notices are the deep, curving lines of the bathtub. Expensive soap and soft towels are at her disposal. The bath mat is plush, and a heavy robe hangs on a hook at the door. The label inside the robe reads, Le Pavillon de la Reine. Favorite hotel in Paris, no doubt. A purchase made on one of the Kleist's many Parisian holidays. The robe probably costs more than the average Berlin factory girl makes in a month, but Anna can't quite bring herself to judge them for the excess. When she drops it across her narrow shoulders. It's heavy like an expensive blanket, and soft like a kitten's ear. It falls all the way to the floor and pools at her feet. Anna sighs audibly and turns on the tap. Anna draws one finger along the faint, striated lines that run vertically across her belly button. It's been so long they are almost invisible now. She drops her hand, takes a deep breath. Refuses to wander down that mental path. Anna shrugs out of the robe and lowers herself into the soapy water beneath the open window. Below her are the sounds of city life, the early evening commotion of businesses closing for the day, cars and horns and delivery trucks, wealthy women chatting in French and German and Russian as they leave the shops below, little affluent cliques of émigrés bent beneath the weight of their shopping bags. Laughter drifts up from the cafes and mixes oddly with the crying of a child in the courtyard across the street. The water in this tub is still warm, and she is clean. It's all a miracle. Anna relaxes finally, ridiculously happy for the first time in years.
Chapter 24. Anastasia. The House of Special Purpose. 1918. Trans-Siberian Railway, halfway to Ekaterinburg, May 24th. Once, before the revolution, my siblings and I studied ancient Rome. Gilliard led the expedition, beginning with the conquest of the Sabines in the 8th century BC and ending when Rome burned to the ground in AD 64. He took that opportunity to foist Latin upon us, insisting it was the foundation of literature, and without it, we would be illiterate. I might have taken to the language, if not for a single word learned early in our review of the Sabines. Raptio. Rape. The rape of the Sabines. A singular moment in history made famous by Renaissance painters and sculptors. Romulus's mass kidnapping of women from villages surrounding Rome. The poor daughters of Sabine were lured to a festival hosted by the men of Rome, and once there, were taken away and compelled to marry their captors. Human plunder. Along with the Latin and the history, we studied the paintings themselves. Gilliard argued, supported by the writings of a number of scholars, Livy among them, that what transpired in Rome was better translated as conquest than violation. And to prove his point, he took us on a field trip. It took days to reach Paris on the imperial train, but upon our arrival, Gilliard wasted no time in shuffling us directly to the Louvre, where he had arranged a private viewing of Nicolas Poussin's The Abduction of the Sabine Women. So obsessed was the artist with this subject that he painted it twice in his lifetime. And, to Poussin's credit, I respected the fact that he depicted the women fully clothed. Pietro da Cortona, Jacques Stellar, Johann Heinrich Schoenfeld, and Peter Paul Rubens all rendered the women in various stages of voluptuous nudity. Almost all of them titled their paintings The Rape of the Sabine Women. Raptio. Rape. Rapacious. Rapine. Raptor. Ravish. Only in Latin can one root word be the basis for myriad appalling descriptors. Horrible, vulgar, violent words. Brutish and masculine. I hate them all, and the language from which they originated. Latin deserves to be a dead language, and I do not mourn it. Now, as the train rattles west toward Ekaterinburg, I think it's a pity that Nicolas Poussin and his contemporaries did not open their fields of artistic expression to women. I am certain female painters would have eradicated the themes of masculine valor from those bright, chaotic canvases. They would have illustrated, as legend did in the end, that the Sabines, and not the soldiers, were the saviors of Rome. The train is silent now, and the night terrors are replaced by an eeriness that settles heavily in the air. Beside me, the thin cushion shifts, and the soldier who lies there slides from the berth. Pretending to be asleep, I listen as he slips quietly from our compartment. Only when he is gone do I roll over and look out the window. The sky is cold, the color of gunmetal, and I can see only broken glimpses of it as we pass through a towering forest. Above me, Alexei and Joy snore in soft, whistling harmony. My brother fell asleep in the night, too exhausted and traumatized to stay alert any longer. It was a relief, to be honest. He could offer no protection, and I didn't want him remembering anyway. I lie awake until Semyon slides the door open and shoves Olga back into the compartment. She flinches when the door slams closed again. Olga seems like a ghost, standing there in the gloom, wringing her hands. When she finally looks at me, her eyes are glassy, bottomless. "Are you okay?" I whisper, knowing that she's not. I want to embrace her. I want to weep. But she appears so fragile in her rumpled clothing, so temporal, that I am afraid she will disintegrate at the slightest touch. "No," Olga says, and crawls into the berth directly across from mine. She draws the thin blanket across her shoulders, pulls her knees into her chest, and closes her eyes. Sleep is her only refuge, and she races toward it. Within seconds, the rise and fall of her chest is slow and rhythmic. "Please, God," I whisper, "do not let her dream." Tatiana stumbles in on her own a few minutes later. She goes straight to the window, her face slick with tears, her lips swollen. Tatiana adjusts her clothing, checking the buttons on her blouse, and then straightening her skirt. She runs her hands through her tangled hair, combing it with her fingers, then spreads them across the fabric of her blouse, over and over, trying to press the wrinkles away. Finally, when her sobs became so hard she cannot catch a breath in between, she lays her forehead against the window. I fear she might shove it aside and throw herself out. "I am so sorry about Ultimo," I say. My voice is ragged from all the crying I've done myself, but I have to say something, and everything else feels unmentionable. "I wish I'd drawn the short straw," Tatiana says, her voice empty of all emotion. I wish I'd been the one to go with Mother and Father. I had wished this for myself 100 times during the night and cannot escape the guilt I feel for having done so. The only comfort I can offer Tatiana is to confess it. So do I. When Tatiana finally turns from the window, she looks hollowed out. Whereas Olga's eyes were filled with sorrow, hers are altogether empty. My sister stands before me, but she is missing somehow, removed from her body. So I lift my blanket, and she climbs in beside me, rigid and straight, as though fearing human contact. We lie there, back to back, unspeaking, as the train slowly rocks her back to sleep. I think about the daughters of Sabine as I drift away myself. The purpose of art, Gilliard had said as we stood on the polished marble floors of the Louvre, is to tell the truth. He waved an arm at the canvas, at the boldly painted forms of tangled humans crowding that Roman courtyard. Without those women, there would be no Rome, he said. The greatest empire on earth would never have existed. That great city would have been left to decay within a generation. Yet I knew now that both Gilliard and Nicolas Poussin were mistaken about the most fundamental aspect of the story. There is nothing artistic about rape. Taking a woman by force makes a man no better than the rooster in Tobolsk. It simply makes him an animal. We arrive in Ekaterinburg at midnight. The soldiers immediately file from the train and crowd onto the platform for instruction. Within moments, dim electric lights flicker on, and we can see them head to the freight cars and begin to unload our belongings. We watch, faces pressed to the window, as they grab boxes and trunks and pieces of furniture and toss them onto the droshkies, open four-wheeled carriages pulled by enormous draft horses. It begins to rain within the hour, and the temperature drops soon after. Twice I catch a glimpse of Tomas and Ivan shivering in the cold, their lips forming curse words that I am forbidden to speak aloud. At some point my siblings and I fall asleep again, huddled together for warmth on one of the lower berths. We are woken intermittently by the stomping and cursing of the soldiers. Every time the door to our car slams open, we cringe. Every time we hear footsteps in the hallway, we grab one another tighter. But the soldiers leave us alone that night. And when morning dawns, hours later, we get the first real glimpse of our new home. Despite it being late May, snow is still on the ground in Ekaterinburg. It is piled high against the sides of buildings and shoveled into dirty heaps in the gutters. The streets are filled with mud, and the sidewalks lined with spectators. Beyond the train station is a sprawling city of square stone buildings with small windows and sloping roofs. The city is built not on a grid, as one would expect, but on a system of meandering streets and narrow dead-end lanes that remind me of the deer trails outside Saskoye Selo. The Iset River runs through the middle of the city, forming a respectable lake at its widest point, and then narrows again as it turns to the south. Around this lake are built the wealthiest homes, but we can see only the barest glimpse of the broad, silver water from where we stand on the platform. Alexei holds on to Olga and Tatiana, and I think that the three of them look like a tiny, despondent island amid the activity. Heads bent together, eyes downcast, shoulders rounded, exhausted, weepy, hungry, demoralized. My siblings are broken, and the only thing that can help is being delivered safely into the arms of our parents. Gilliard stands beside me, and I turn to ask how much longer we have to wait, but his attention is at my feet, his frown causing that spectacular moustache to droop at the corners. He blinks 3 times, then bends his mouth to my ear and asks quietly, "What is that? Please, for the love of God, do not say it is a knife." My laces have come undone, and in the process, Father's paper knife has come loose from its hiding spot, the mother of pearl handle standing out against the black leather of my boot. No, I say, shaking my head slowly so as not to draw attention from the guards who swirl around us. It is a paper knife.
A letter opener? Have you lost your mind? Do you think these men will make a distinction between a paper knife and a regular knife? They will only see a weapon, and they will punish you for having it.
I don't care.
You should. Your life is worth more than you think, and angering these men to make a point is unwise.
You have a high estimation of my life. I do not think these men share it.
Then that is all the more reason for you to guard it ferociously.
Now you want me to be ferocious. I wish that freedom extended to the schoolroom.
I fear your lessons have come to an end, Tsarevna. Now is the time for you to put them into practice.
I nod toward my boot. Pity sword fighting wasn't part of your curriculum.
I'd hardly call that a sword. And besides...
He lets go of my wrist and taps my temple soundly with one finger.
This is the weapon I expect you to use going forward.
He is a good man, sturdy and steadfast, and I haven't given him enough credit. He looks so somber that I feel a rush of affection for him. Any sharpness therein is a credit to you. He does smile then, proudly, but looks away when my eyes begin to cloud.
You have a remarkable disposition, Anastasia. Has anyone ever told you that?
Oh, it's been remarked upon endlessly. He snorts, but I've apparently enjoyed the last of Gilliard's humour because he returns to his typical stoic demeanour.
I need you to stand very still,
he says. Why?
Because I'm going to tie the laces of your boot. And you are going to let me.
I want to say that I need the paper knife, that its sharp blade and wicked point are a comfort in the night when every door is unlocked and wicked men roam the halls. But to explain that is to invite questions I am not ready to answer. So I nod, and Gilliard goes down on both knees beside me. The sleight of hand is so swift I almost do not see that slim blade slide into his shirt sleeve.
Is there something wrong with her boot?
Gilliard ignores the question, his nimble fingers now tightening and looping my laces. I wait until he is done to lift my foot and show Semyon the hole in the end of my boot. He stares at the ripped leather and the stocking-clad toe that peeks out from beneath it.
Indeed there is,
I say, anger pulsing in every word.
I will need new ones.
Semyon knows that we have not told our servants what happened on the train. He knows, I am certain, because his teeth remain intact. They'd be knocked out otherwise. I do not doubt that Semyon considers this a victory, that he thinks we are ashamed. So he smiles, cold and cruel.
I believe that the ones you have will last until the end of your life.
A single carriage comes to collect us. Even as we stare at the six available seats, we do not immediately understand what this means. I think Gilliard knew all along, however.
You will go no farther,
Semyon says when our tutor moves toward the carriage.
They go on from here alone.
As women, we are taught that bravery and valour exist in the grand gestures. We believe that kindness is weakness and arrogance is the same as courage. But it is not so. Sometimes restraint proves the mettle of a man's heart more accurately. Gilliard could argue or throw a punch. He could slip the paper knife from his sleeve and drive it through Semyon's throat. It would be satisfying, I won't lie. But he takes the nobler course instead. He steps back. And in doing so, not only protects us, but also saves his own life.
Smart man,
Semyon hisses, the words whistling between his teeth.
Now leave while you can.
Gilliard is circumspect in his farewells to each of us. A kiss to the cheek, a formal bow without regard to the consequences, and a single word whispered in our ears.
Tsarevna,
he says, face turned to stone, emotions squelched. We watch him board the train and disappear inside the compartment before we climb into our carriage. When we left the Alexander Palace all those months ago, we were accompanied by a skeleton crew. Now it is only the four of us, Cook and Botkin in the carriage, followed by several dozen of Semyon's guards. They jog steadily behind us as we rattle through the streets. Alexei holds Joy firmly in his lap, but Jimmy refuses to climb up with us, so he trots along beside, dodging puddles in the street and keeping clear of the wheels. Occasionally, he looks up at me for encouragement, but he never lags behind. Once, when I glance over my shoulder, I see Thomas in the group of soldiers directly behind the carriage. He doesn't look at me. His gaze hovers protectively over Jimmy, and I love him for it. It is an unnerving thought to have in such a moment. I love him. It is a stunning, wonderful, entirely human realization at the worst possible moment. I am headed to prison, and I am in love with a boy. It takes a good 5 minutes before I am able to take in my surroundings once more, and then reality comes crashing in again. The rickety carriage, the bustling street, the stomp of soldiers' feet behind me. Whereas Tobolsk was utterly flat and nearly treeless, Ekaterinburg boasts rolling hills and numerous parks. The farther we travel into the city, the prettier it becomes, and the more attention we get. It must be odd, I suppose, to see our carriage clatter by, followed by ranks of armed soldiers. People stand on the streets and point. They stare from open doors and windows. They whisper to one another or dart out of the way when we draw close. I spot our destination from the bottom of the hill. A giant wooden fence has been built across the front of a house, effectively blocking it from view. The fence is 2 stories high and made of rough-hewn wood. So new are those planks that they glow golden in the morning light. Once we pull up beside it, the smell of pine is pervasive, and I can see little rivulets of sap running down the boards and pooling in the knots. Semyon kicks against the gate, and it swings open a moment later, revealing a 2-story stone building. It is the color of bisque and perfectly rectangular. The roofline is ornamented with corbels, and there is a fountain in the courtyard. But there are bars across the windows, and armed guards stand at the front door.
Welcome, Semyon says, to the House of Special Purpose.
Chapter 25. Anna. 2 years at Daldorf. 1922-1921. Daldorf Asylum, Berlin. May 30th, 1922. Anna once lived through a night so long and so excruciating, she thought it would last an eternity. Each minute seemed to stretch like taffy softened in the sun, pulled to its thinnest, most tender strand. She believed that if she was lucky enough to survive that night, she would live in slow motion forever. The experience became a door in her mind that, when pushed too hard, swings toward madness. In the years since, as her episodes have become less frequent, Anna still distrusts time itself. She suspects that it is in league with the enemy, and the wretched memories embedded in her mind. She fears that time will forever be slower for her, that each injustice and hardship and cruelty will have to be lived through at half speed. So it comes as a surprise to her how quickly her days at Daldorf slip away. First a handful, then dozens at a time with her barely noticing them. Weeks, a month, a year, then two, each day falling into a predictable rhythm. In the years that Anna has been housed within these walls, there have been very few surprises. She wakes and dresses and goes to eat in a small communal area with the other residents of her ward. She is often allowed to work on the grounds or in the sewing room. The staff is careful not to give her scissors or anything else that could be transformed into a weapon. Anna finds